recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the James Eastman Building in beautiful downtown Chesapeake, Virginia. It's Phantasmo After Dark with your host, Rob Floyd, and special guest co-host, Tony Mercer, Esquire.
That's me.
Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to the old podcast. And hey, Tony, welcome back again.
Thank you, sir.
And I'm serious. One of these days, we are going to get together and get Clayton here over the satellite and do that Frankenstein podcast we've been talking about.
One of these days, I'm going to change my evil ways. But until then, keep riding on.
What was it Casey Kasem used to say? And keep sending in your anyway.
And he writes, Dear Casey.
We'll edit all this out. But
no, we won't.
No,
Phyllis won't.
Yeah, no, Phyllis won't. But hey, tonight's topic, what you're here to actually listen to, you know, if you are out there listening, is Invasion of the B-Girls is what we're talking about. And this film is something. There you go. We're done.
What could that something possibly be?
No. You know, it's an odd little film. You got a cast of people who've it's worth watching for them alone. You got Bill Smith, you know, William Smith, who's been in everything. Conan's dad, Any Which Way You Can, the Russian General in Red Dawn, TV all through the 60s, 70s, and 80s. He's got like about 300 credits if you look on IBM, IMDb. I don't know, he may be into computers too, who
you
knows?
You can use your IBM to look him up on IMDb.
I mean, the cat speaks five languages, you know, he may be in it. And you talk about, I mean, that guy, you talk about a career besides his acting, okay? He went to the University of Munich, graduated cum laude from UCLA. Maybe that too. Was a Russian prisoner interrogator during the Korean War. He's done a lot of stuff. And a bodybuilder on top of that, in addition to all his acting credits. Besides Bill, you've got Anitra Ford, okay, Big Bird Cage, and also was the villain in the Kathleen Crosby Wonder Woman film.
And a Barker's Beauty.
And, yeah, one of the first Price is Right girls. That's right. Victoria Vetri?
Vetri. Or, yeah, I don't actually know.
But Playmate of the Year, 1968.
Vetri, yeah. She was in When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth, I think. The Hammer movie.
And something interesting I found out about her. Sometime in the 80s, she was doing 9 years for shooting her husband.
What?
Yeah.
She does kind of have like a hard look around the eyes, don't she?
Yeah, she's got kind of a crazy Sharon look. I'm going to leave that, let that go right there. Cliff Osmond, who's one of those cats who's been in everything. Like a small part, but you've seen him in everything. Wright King. Who is Wright King, you may ask?
Who is Wright King?
Dr. Galen from Planet of the Apes.
Nice.
Yep. We're talking to Zero right there. And Renee Bond as one of the B-girls uncredited.
Now I will confess I missed that.
Yeah, and if you don't know who Renee Bond is, either you don't need to be listening to this or you should listen more often. One or the other, get an education. That's all I'm saying.
Let's just say her career trajectory is rather relevant to the discussion of this film.
I think. All over cult films in the 70s and softcore. Didn't she do some actual porn, some hardcore porn?
Yeah, she did later on, I think.
Yeah, and then lots of nudie cutie films from, you know.
Yeah, like later on, I think she got herself some implants and took up with the hardcore scene.
If you're an aficionado of the Something Weird video library, as I am, she's in Country Cousins.
Yeah, I think she's got a couple of titles out under
all
the
her glory.
Something Weird banner.
Another thing, some of the specs on this before we get into talking about the actual film. This came out in 73.
Hey, I came out in 73.
Hey, wow. Well, does your wife know?
It's like a T-ball. You just kind of set it up. And
Nicholas Meyer wrote it.
Oh, see, you should have saved that for like a big reveal later or something.
Okay, we'll edit that out. Which we'll get into more of this.
It is the first screen credit of a young Nick Meyer.
That's right.
Writer, director of still the greatest Star Trek movie ever made, The Wrath of Khan.
That's right. And this one he tried, when they did rewrites on this and he found out about it, he tried to have his name removed from the credits.
Yeah, we'll talk about that, I think, as we go along.
In 1998, there was a sequel play done in Seattle called Beyond the Invasion of the B-Girls. That's all I could find out on it. Couldn't find any other information on that other than it happened.
Okay.
Oh, Bill Smith, his bio.
It was like experimental feminist theater or something like that, yeah. Right? Right? Right?
Probably.
I bet it was. I bet you that's true.
Bill Smith's bio on IMDb. The first line is biker, bare knuckle brawler, cowboy, b-girl fighter, vampire hunter. William Smith has done it all.
Hell yeah.
There you go. I think we're done.
Good night, everybody.
Oh, another thing, too. This was one of the DVD re-releases, and actually, I guess a theatrical re-release, was retitled Graveyard Tramps.
Oh, yeah. I think I knew that at some point.
I have no idea why.
No, well.
Nary a graveyard is seen in the film.
Best not to ask.
But there's lots of tramps.
Hey, now. You don't know that.
Look, all the guys that die, they're suspected of dying and being screwed to death. So, I'm just saying.
Oh, you mean nice young ladies playing tramps.
Yes, yes.
Okay,
yes.
Well, that's acceptable.
Oh, and a little bit of trivia in this. And this is on IMDb. This isn't me, but it should have been me. I should have thought of this. It's called Invasion of the B-Girls. Not a one of the girls of the B-Girls is a B-Cup.
Well, good night, folks.
And you can check for yourself. There's a lot of nudity in this film.
There is, but I don't know. I don't know Anitra Ford's cup size.
It's not a B, I can tell you that.
No?
Like, well, no. Well, I don't know. Her?
Yeah.
Could be.
She's svelte.
Yeah, yeah. It's a small C or a big B.
Okay.
So she's the queen bee.
That's why you didn't think about it.
No, the bee girls. She's the queen.
That's why they only thought about it, whoever commented that on IMDb rather than you, because instinctively you knew better than to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, we all played our strengths, you know?
Yeah.
So, anyway, about the film itself, though,
yeah.
Tony.
So, did you actually like it? And had you seen it before?
Yeah, I'd seen it years ago. Years ago. I've got the same copy that I've had is a no-budget double feature DVD, which I think was a rip from the original VHS, the quality-wise. But I was reading somewhere the other night that the recent release of it, not the Blu-ray, but the official DVD release.
Yeah.
Part of one of the scenes is cut out that is on the older VHS release. One of the love scenes, I think it's when the housewife who turns her husband down at the beginning has that great line.
Yeah.
He says, well, you know, absence won't be a problem in this house. And she said, well, if I thought it would kill you, I'd do it.
Right.
You know, great line. Later on, when she turns around and starts seducing him, I think it's part of that scene is cut out. Like her nudity that you see
really
is what I was reading. But on the older releases, it's not. Now, the new Blu-ray that came out just this month,
yeah,
I don't know if it's restored or not. I haven't seen it.
Well, all I can say is I have the new Blu-ray, and that's what I rewatched to have this discussion. And it's nice. It looks really good. And I remember that scene pretty much the same as...
Okay.
I mean, I can't really see what would have been cut. Now, the DVD copy that I have is also from Shout Factory, but it's one of those four film drive-in features deals or whatever.
Uh-huh. I know the one you're talking
about. And, you know, one of those ones you get for $7 or $8 at Best Buy on a good day. One of the better ones, because also I don't remember all four of them that are on there, but Unholy Rollers is on there.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of fun.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
The one that I've got is a double feature. I don't know why. It's Invasion of the B-Girls and The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant.
Nice.
And it's weird, though, because it's one of those where they try to make it like the drive-in experience, but it's not really. They put a cartoon in between features and a couple of commercials. Now, it's not trailers, but like actual TV toy commercials. It's a very odd disc.
That is very odd.
If anybody there does want to see Invasion of the B-Girls, though, it's probably on YouTube because I think it's in the public domain. It is on Roku. One of the Roku channels has it. I know that.
Just buy the Blu-ray.
Yeah, but just buy the Blu-ray. You want to see good quality. As a matter of fact, when we get done with this, I'd like to preview a little bit of that and see the quality.
Yeah. I wish I had known... I would have queued up at least one scene.
Yeah.
And I'll mark out which one as we go along.
Okay.
But, so you had seen it before. You did enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I mean, you know, like I said, anything. I watch Bill Smith in just about anything. And he has done really good stuff, just like a lot of the character actors that we really like. You know, he's done some really good stuff. He's done some mediocre stuff. And he's done some crap. Paying the bills, man. But this is one of those where It could have been really campy, the premise, the story and everything, but they got decent actors in it, and it's played really straight. So you don't really think that it could be campy if you're getting into it, the story. You know what I mean?
I have to say that I've got to be careful here not to oversell this thing, because, you know, we should be clear what we're talking about. This is essentially a sexploitation movie. It's hearted up as a drive-in sci-fi thriller, right? Or you could call
That's very good, yes.
You could also maybe reverse that. You could say it's a drive-in sci-fi thriller dressed up as a sexploitation movie, but...
You know, you're right, because it really, it straddles a line. It doesn't go... It's just enough of either one to be called either one, but it doesn't go full into the sexploitation. Yeah. It doesn't go full into the sci-fi.
Well, there's sort of key elements of it, or certain choices that are made that sort of put it, I would put it in that first order. If it's a sexploitation movie, that's sort of its raison d'etre. But I suspect, like, we'll never know what that script was before. Before and after the changes.
Yeah, see, that I'd like to find out. I'd love to read that.
There are some things in it that I think that I personally, and again, we don't know, we can only speculate, but there are some things in it that I would personally assume are Nick Meyer. There's a certain, particularly in maybe the first 40 minutes or so as things are ramping up, there's a certain wit to it.
Yeah.
And a certain pace to it that I think helps it overcome its roots, if you will, and keeps it entertaining and light, but not in a goofy way, in a way that's genuinely amusing. So I definitely want to give Meyer a lot of credit for that. And I guess if I have to guess, I would say that it started out maybe as a straight sci-fi thriller with some humor and some opportunities for feminine pulchritude that maybe got doctored into something a little bit more full-on sexploitation. But, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he always kind of knew what he was getting into. But again, the point is that it's a sexploitation movie. It's a drive-in. You know, it's schlock, essentially. Yeah. But I really like this. I think it's really... Yeah. I really do. It's on a relative scale compared to other films of its ilk. I think it's really good. And that's what I mean when I say I have to be careful. Is I don't want to oversell it as this great film, because it isn't.
No, okay. it's definitely not. At one point, watching it, because I watched it, like I said, years ago, and I could tell you what it was about. I could tell you the plot, really. I watched it twice recently. One time, I just had it on while I was doing other stuff, and then the other night, I did sit down and watch it. And I turned to Phyllis at one point, I'm like, you know, I could tell you the plot, but I really don't know what this movie's about.
Well, there's a...
You know, because there's certain... we'll go through the plot real quick.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. But it's like, where did it come from, and what's the point of what they're doing, and where did this come from? Stuff like that. But the basic plot, there's this little town in, where is it, in California somewhere?
I don't know that they even say
and
it. But it
has a government research facility there.
Hosts a research facility, right.
And it's kind of a, it seems like it's a southern town if it's California. Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's somewhere in the south because of the union
guys. It's small town USA.
Yeah, that's where it is.
70 small town USA, and you should really be able to visualize exactly what mean when I say that.
And it was definitely, it came out in 73, and it does take place in the 70s. There's a couple of murders or a couple of deaths happen at this research facility. It's a government on what, atomic energy and bio something. So they send in a government agent to check it out, and the government agent is Neil Agar.
Ah, I see what they did there.
Yeah. Bill Smith comes to check it out, playing a good guy. Because usually he plays bad guys. He's known for bad guys, even though he has played some good guy roles.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm surprised that he didn't get more, like, leading good guy roles, because he's a good-looking guy. Cut, good acting chops, but they cast him as bad guys more often, you know. But anyway, they send him in to investigate, along with the sheriff, the deaths, and deaths keep piling up. Always, like, 10 guys in 3 days, and it's all men.
Well, the specific circumstances of the deaths are made clear from the first one, which is that apparently the victims, and we assume they're victims early on, die
with
from
a smile on their face.
Exertion during intercourse.
Yeah.
In other words, they have so much sex that their hearts give out.
Yeah. So throughout the investigation, Bill is investigating the research facility, and the cop is just investigating the deaths. And each time we go back to the coroner, and you see the corpse with the wide eyes and mouth open, frozen look on her face, which is always funny when they show that. They cut to that and then cut back to what's going on. And he's interviewing the different people, trying to find out what's going on. And he gets a confidant, one of the, who turns into kind of a love interest.
Well, there's a hot lady scientist
Yeah.
who is, of course, you know, she's got her hair all pinned up and glasses on. And,
Victoria Vetri.
And yeah. her business attire on. Yeah. So she's got the whole naughty librarian thing where you just know if she drops the hair and takes off the glasses, you're in trouble. But he befriends or is befriended by her because love interest and also Victoria Vetri.
That's right. And then he finds out that the female scientist, Anitra Ford, who always has sunglasses on, and other scientists. Oh, yeah.
The female scientist, the super hot female scientist, Anitra Ford, who the men in the facility refer to as the iceberg.
Yeah. Oh, you'll never have a chance with her. Because apparently this facility, since they're all working together all the time, there's a lot of sexual shenanigans. And even Victoria Vetri's character says a lot.
Yeah, she gets a little voiceover where she talks about all the hanky-panky that goes
on. Swapping and all that, just because to ease the tension and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, that's basically what's going on, and you come to find out that the men are dying. Anitra Ford's character is taking the wives, pretty much, or girlfriends of these guys, and turning them into B-girls. Into her secret lab, exposing them. Sticks them, this pin that looks like a bee, something sticks them in the neck, which I guess is some kind of drug. Then they coat them in the stuff, which looks like, you know, marshmallow.
It's supposed to be wax.
Yeah, but it looks like melted marshmallow. Coats them in that like a cocoon, puts them in this radiation chamber. All these bees encase the cocoon, and then they pull them out of the radiation chamber, peel the wax off of them, and they're like younger and hotter, and their eyes are black, completely blacked over.
Well, it's not even that they're younger or hotter. It's just that their beauty is downplayed in the hair and makeup and wardrobe before they go in the chamber.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, that's what it's implying is they come out of this as they're rejuvenated.
It's a makeover machine, basically.
Yeah. Then they seduce more guys and kill. So it's like a vampire thing as far as one makes one and one makes two, two, three, four, five. And they keep killing more. And then there's a confrontation at the end. They get Victoria Vetri and Bill goes and saves the day and... That's basically the point.
So you don't see the first actual B-girl conversion process until about the 50-minute mark or so. And I want to come back to that scene and talk about it specifically. But until that point, you get, you know, at first it's just, you know, dead bodies turn up. You see a man hooking up with a woman and then his dead body turns up. And eventually you get full-on sex scenes and guys dying as a result of the full-on sex scenes. And then finally it sort of culminates in the reveal of the B-girl conversion process. And then from that point on, you see the full process of the B-girls seducing and laying and killing the men. But early on...
It's a slow build, though.
Yeah. Early on, sort of one of the exceptions to that, there is one sort of full-on hookup that you see sort of during the phase when you're not seeing much, but the end results. That is it's a visual gag that I just loved. And I remember the first time I saw it, I was like, are you kidding me? So it's a young couple is driving a motorcycle through the countryside and they stop someplace out in the field and they... strip and start making out.
But wait, are they riding the bikes naked at some point?
Well, when they are on the motorcycle, she doesn't start naked, I don't think, like in the long shot.
Yeah.
But then you see him off the motorcycle naked, and then it pans back or cuts or whatever to her sitting on the motorcycle naked.
Yeah.
And then she gets off the motorcycle naked, and they start making out. And then they lay down, and they're in a lover's embrace entwined with one another, and they start rolling down a hill. Like they're literally doing the rolling down a hill in the pastoral field thing. And I'm sitting here watching it going, are we seriously rolling down a hill right now? Are we really doing this?
And embraced then and naked.
The great thing is that when you get to when they finish rolling, when they get to the bottom, it's just him flopped over dead. And then you see her standing over him and then she steps over him and walks up the hill.
Yeah.
So what you... start out thinking is this, you know, how are we seriously going to indulge in this ridiculous cliche moment turns into a great gag at the end where he's all by himself and dead by the time he gets to the bottom of that hill. And I really appreciated that little bit of a visual wit there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it comes, like you say, it comes at a point.
I probably didn't describe that well.
But no, you did. You did. You did. It comes to the point towards the beginning of the film where you don't really know what's going on. And that happens. You're like, what did she do to him?
You know? Yeah. Well, you see her naked backside as she walks away from his
dead body.
Don't
you see her black eyes?
I don't think you see the back of the black eyes. I could be wrong.
Oh, okay.
I don't think, not yet.
Okay.
I could be wrong about that, but I don't think so.
Yeah. Like I said, the way this movie plays, it could have been played campy and for laughs, but it's not. Even that scene right there, you know, you're like, like you say, you're going, oh, geez, are they really doing this role? And then she gets up and he's dead. You're like, wait a minute. What just happened?
Well, yeah, it's light and humorous and it's got some wit to it, but I wouldn't describe it as camp per se.
It could have been played that way.
Technical actual meaning of camp as opposed to the way that it's sort of liberally misused. The way that camp is liberally misused, I think plenty of people would call it campy, but that's getting into personal pet peeves of mine.
Okay, let me rephrase it. It could have been, the whole movie could have been played tongue-in-cheek. It could have been played for laughs, but it's not. It's played straight, and it works as a straight, serious drive-in sci-fi sexploitation film, where it could have been more goofy. You know, they could have been played up the queen bee angle and could have had more, you know, the bumbling cop kind of deal, you know?
Yeah, I see exactly what you mean.
But it's not because
the cop gets a couple of funny bits, but it's not at his expense because he's such a bumpkin.
It's more just situational, like, oh, geez, you know, more like that, like real people.
There's a moment, and this probably doesn't tickle anybody but me, but there's just a moment where they're at the scene of another death, and the sheriff turns to Bill Smith and says, "They're dropping like flies, Agar. They're dropping like flies." And it just tickled me. Just the way he said it. I don't know. But anyway.
You know, I think they got a pretty decent chemistry, though.
Yeah.
Cliff Osmond there and Bill Smith. It just seems like a couple of real guys doing their jobs. You know? And there's that one point where Cliff Osmond, they're at the scene of one of the crimes, and he gets a little pissed off or something Bill's character says. He says, hey, look, I just want to apologize to you. I might have been stepping on your toes the last couple of days. And Cliff says, you're uptight, I'm uptight, this whole situation's uptight, it's okay. So like a couple guys just relating, you know, going, okay, we just calm down. I don't know, it made it more kind of like it's a real scene and not, we're in this sci-fi movie, you know, type of thing, you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So another thing I appreciated about the dialogue early on is the liberal use of the word ball.
I was going to bring that up. That is not a term, a slang term you hear or have heard.
You just don't hear
for
that
a few
one
decades.
That's right.
That is one that definitely went out with the 70s.
And we balled and balled and balled.
For those of you not in the know, the term to ball or ball was another slang term the same for screwing, getting it on, doing it, that you don't hear anymore. That is one that was used a lot too in the 70s. And it didn't make it to the 80s.
Nope.
But yeah, everybody says it in this movie, I think, when they're talking about it, just pretty much. Even the redneck union worker guy.
Oh, okay. So that's one of my favorite
bits. That's one of my favorite lines.
That's one of my favorite bits. So they hold it once there's been a few deaths and they know... They don't know what's going on, but they know that men are dying during sex, and there's like an epidemic of this in the town. Right?
Yeah.
They hold a town hall meeting, the cops and a few of the scientists, and they're addressing the townsfolk, which are your salt of the earth, working class,
business owners.
Look for the union label type folks, as you might expect. And there's the one doctor saying, "I've got a theory so puzzling." And that's the only so puzzling theory guy who we need to talk about again later. That's the only, I can't remember his name, but I remember him saying, "I got a theory so puzzling."
I remember his name.
So what is it?
Dr. Murger.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because it sounds like Dr. Murder.
Yeah, we got to come back to him.
It's Murger.
We got to come back
to him.
That's
right, King.
So he's saying, you know, we don't know what's going on yet, but we know there's a problem. We're doing the best that we can. And in the meantime, we're going to have to ask everyone to there's like a curfew they're going to impose.
Yeah.
And they have to ask everybody to refrain from sex. And there's a murmur in the crowd, and this one old dude gets up, this you know, leader of the local union,
big beefy guy,
206 whatever, gets up and says,
"Best
we
line
put
in the
up
movie.
With a go ahead.
Best line is something about, "I'm not gonna put up with that crap. Nobody's gonna stop me from balling my old lady or anybody else I want to for that matter."
Well, he says something
in front of the whole town.
You've asked an awful lot of us, and we've gone along with it, but nobody's going to tell me that I got to give up the little bit of the pleasure I get from balling my old lady when I get home at night. And,
or anybody else that I want to. He adds that. I mean, right in front of everybody, like, "Well, yeah, that's okay."
So good.
And he has another discussion at the bar with the guys a little bit later.
Yeah.
He says balling again. Man, we've done like 5 minutes on the word balling. It's an important part of the film. We need to address it.
So, town hall guy. And
he gets it after that. I think when he's leaving the bar that night. one of the B-girls gets him.
Okay, yeah. The wife, a lady who is identified as the wife of the first victim. Because, you know, he's sort of the first one they're investigating. So he's the one sort of like the most questions have been framed around. You know, who was he seeing? Was he sleeping around? What was going on in the lab? And she gets a phone call saying, we need to talk about your husband. It's, you know, for the sake of his good name. And
an anonymous phone call from a woman.
And the woman says, you know, I'll pick you up at such and such time, such and such a place. And you know, she's at home sort of all frumped out and I guess in mourning or whatever she's supposed to be. And the next time we see her, she's all dolled up and looking hot with the sunglasses on at the town hall meeting. And she, the town hall guy, the union guy, the ballin' my old lady guy, is checking her out. And then, to our surprise, she starts checking him out. And then when he's at the bar, she finds him, and then they hook up off screen. And then the next thing you know, he turns up dead too. And it's either, I can't remember if it's that or when Murger gets it, where it's the scene of, and again, this is just something that tickles me, of the sheriff saying, "They're dropping like flies, Agar." They're dropping like flies. So Dr. Murger, who is, I've got a theory, so puzzling guy.
Yeah.
He gets run over by a car.
Pretty brutal.
That's
too.
How he gets it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we find out why later, but I think it's either after that death or after Union Guy's death when we're at the scene of the crime and Agar and Victoria Vitry are there. Agar and Vitry wander off and he's got to make a call at a payphone on a payphone on the dark street in the middle of the night.
Yeah, because this is in the 70s, kids. There's no such thing as cell phones at this point.
And there's been in the background. At the scene of the crime, there were these thugs kind of hanging out and catcalling.
Around the other side of the building is where
our heroine. And Bill Smith needs to wait for a callback on his payphone from his government contact. So he says, "Hey, why don't you go wait in the car? You know, by yourself in that dark alley over there." And she complies. And sure enough, the thugs show up and there's a suspense sequence of an attempted rape where, you know, they assault her and rip her shirt off and they're, you know, giving her a hard time. And we keep cutting back to Bill Smith waiting on his phone call. And of course, you know, the suspense aspect is we're waiting for him to get his shit together and go rescue her before something even more horrible happens. And, one of the odd details. So there's four guys, I think, and they've got her, first against the wall, and then they move her over to the hood of the car right before they're going to do, you know, the shit they're going to do. But they, you know, take off her top and one of the odd details that I notice is that the lead thug gets down by her breasts and starts blowing smoke on her boobs.
Yeah, I saw that one guy. I'm like, what the hell is he doing?
And he does it a couple times.
Is he just killing time? Like, what?
I'm going, what? What is that for?
And the other Avery Schreiber looking guy who's holding her holding her head back is like, get you some,
yeah, get you some, just blowing just smoke rings giggling on her nipples or something. I don't know. So eventually the action moves over to the hood of the car and they're, you know, seriously going to rape her now. And right before things get really ugly and zippers are unzipped and the whole thing, Agar shows up and whoops everybody's ass.
Yeah,
and
flies into him like a bat out of hell.
And I really felt this. This whole thing was unnecessary, and I really felt like the attempted rape and the roughing up of Victoria Vitry's character, and I think this is the scene where the movie sort of betrays its roots in sexploitation sleaze, because you know, you have your whole subgenre of sexploitation, the roughies, where you know, it's not just enough to have nudity and sex. You've got to have
some brutality.
Violence and brutality and humiliation and all these things. And even in sexploitation movies that aren't roughies per se, there is often an element of at least one scene of something rough happening.
Yeah.
It just seems to be one of those things that was a staple of the, if you want to call it genre or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
For a long time, you know, one of the more unpleasant aspects of it. And, you know, there's situations sometimes in movies like this where producer or someone decides, you know, we need an opportunity to have some sex and or nudity in this scene. So, so let's have a rape scene, which is gross in and of itself.
Yeah.
To do that for that purpose. And for me, and this is a subject I'm just kind of squeamish about, obviously, but
yeah,
that is not this. because there's plenty of sex and plenty of nudity, and it's an absolute given that we're going to see Victoria Vitri's business at some point. Yeah, there's just no way that's not happening.
It seems inserted and out of place.
So it doesn't even seem to be there as a, you know, we're not going to get to see her or get to have any sex anytime soon. Yeah. Otherwise, so let's do this, which in and of itself would still be icky, but yeah. It seems to be, we specifically want to have some rough stuff. It's just kind of how it comes off to me. Either that, or they just wanted to have give Bill Smith an opportunity to beat several guys up, you know, which is quite possible. But
and, well, you know, I was gonna bring that up. Knowing how he is, actually having met him a couple times, and his wife Joanne, and kind of getting to know how he is as a person. The scene where he lays into those guys because of what they're doing to that girl. That's probably the way it would really happen in real life if he was walking along, because he's one of those guys, he's old school guy. You're polite to women, you pull the chair out, you'll be rude to women, you don't, you know, anybody's going to assault a woman, they're getting a beat down, and these guys are getting ready to brutally rape this woman. He comes sailing around that corner, flies into these guys, beats the shit out of them, kicks them around, and he gets hit a couple times, so it's not like he's, you know, Superman here, but he's beating the crap out of him, and the last guy that's standing, he's got against the wall and is just wailing on him, punching him back and forth, to where Victoria Vitri has to pull Bill off of this guy. He's like, "You're going to kill him." And the guy just falls down in a bloody pulp on the ground. And I could see Bill, he would really do that. It'd be that much of an affront that he would just take care of business. And it's a pretty good little scene. It's not, as far as the fighting goes part, it's not a martial arts fight. It's a tough guy brawling with some thugs and beating the crap out of them.
Well, he does give us a few key eyes, though, in there. A couple of ooh type.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, it's like, he's just sailing. It's not like he's doing, you know, martial arts flying.
No, he's not doing, there's no stances involved or anything. He's just, you know.
No pretty moves.
He's giving the Sagat knee to a couple of guys. That's pretty much what's happening. But, yeah, you know, as we discuss this, I begin to think maybe it's just, I don't like rape scenes and I'm being prudish here.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as a suspense piece, I guess it works the way it's supposed to, right? So we're afraid for her. Something bad's going to happen to her. We want it to not happen to her. We're waiting on him to save her. Is he going to save her? Is he going to save her? And then you finally get the release of him beating their asses. And, you know, and that's how that sort of thing is supposed to function. So,
So
I guess the emotional trajectory the audience is meant to follow for that scene to be effective, that is what is achieved, you know, in that scene, and therefore it works. And so maybe, you know, I shouldn't be so quick to condemn it, but it just feels like
feels forced.
Tonally, it doesn't fit with everything else that we see. I feel like it just doesn't work.
Well, you know, and the
it's like it got imported in terms of matching tonally. It feels like it was imported from somewhere else.
Well, and also too, the seriousness of that scene doesn't carry over to the rest of the movie. As far as then it goes back down to the level that the rest of the movie's been, you know, it doesn't have that emotional tension throughout the rest of the film.
Yeah, I guess that's exactly what I'm trying to say, is that the rest of the movie, it's fun, it's titillating, it's a little bit sexy, a little bit silly, a little bit all that. And then in the middle of it, we have this harrowing, you know, attempt. And we probably spent more time talking about this than it merits.
Well, but I mean, you're right. It's almost like a speed bump in the middle of the film.
Yeah.
Where I see what you're saying. Now, thinking about it more, I see exactly what you're saying. Just watching it in the grindhouse drive-in mindset, it didn't hit me as much of a speed bump, because I'm expecting, like you say, you're almost expecting to see that kind of stuff in these types of films. But the tone of this film, it does kind of go bump, you know, they go back down.
Well, I think that's what I was trying to say when I said it kind of betrays its roots there. Because like I said, I really do, and I probably haven't even emphasized this enough at this stage, I really do like this movie. I think it is definitely a cut or two above a lot of its ilk in terms of its entertainment factor and some elements of it that we haven't gotten to yet, but will. And, you know, I am reasonably well versed in both drive-in schlock and sexploitation and all those things. I've spent my share of time sort of watching and learning about those kinds of movies. So none of these are, the idea that you would have something like that there and why is not foreign to me. It's just, this movie is operating in a lot of ways at a higher level, and then again betrays the roots for a little bit there.
Yeah. It'd be almost like if it went the other direction, like if it had a goofy comedy bit all of a sudden, yeah. Like the bumbling deputy. There's nothing like that anywhere else in the film, tonally, and it would make you go, okay, now we're back to the film again, yeah. You know, because they very easily could have had an excuse for Bill to fight. It could have been in a bar, some guy hitting on the girl and then getting a little rough,
yeah,
you know, or and then trying to punch Bill to get him out of the way. Yeah, there's any number of ways they could have put a fight where he would be motivated to beat the crap out of these guys, to where, like I said, if they in a bar and they pick a fight and they start hitting on the girl and then they punch Bill, a guy gets rough with the girl and then he like holds a broken bottle like he's gonna kill the girl, yeah. Threaten her like that, and then Bill would have beat the crap out of him. Anywhere, which would fit a little more tonally, yeah. I think. But it's there, and the act doesn't happen. Bill prevents it, unlike some other films. And then we get back into the meat of the film.
Yeah, I mean, at least we didn't really have to witness a whole prolonged actual forced intercourse scene, because that really would have put it over the top, and I'd probably have a very different attitude about the movie as a whole. But anyway, so movie gets back on track, and another like just strange little detail that popped out at me when I was watching it again on the Blu-ray was when Agar, Bill Smith, is searching the study of Murger's home.
Oh, yeah. Now,
or the study in Murger's home. It's either his office or his home study or whatever it is. And he's searching or taking a look at what's on the bookshelves. And then on the bookshelves, he finds a switch, and we find out there's a secret door behind the bookshelves.
Now, let's set that up again real quick, though. Murger is the guy that one of the girls went after. And up until this point, all the guys have died from sexual exertion with B girls, or that we know, the audience knows, I guess, but the people in the film don't know. So Murger is the guy where we see him get hit by a car, not die from making it with one of the girls. And you're wondering, why is he getting run over by a car instead of like everybody else? Here's where we find out why.
Yeah, so he's searching the bookshelf and he finds the secret, the switch for the secret door, and finds out there's a secret room behind one of the bookcases. But before we find out what's in the secret room, the strange little detail that I noticed was actually on the bookshelf.
The books. Yeah.
So he was a sex researcher, and he wasn't the only one at that facility, I think.
Yeah.
So the fact that there would be all these books on sex on the bookshelf shouldn't be a surprise, and titles like The Art of Love and The Joy of Sex and
Group Sex.
Group Sex in big letters on one of the books. So all these books on the shelf are sex books, except one. Did you notice this?
No, I don't think so.
There was a book on the shelf entitled Exotic Aquarium Fishes. And when I first spotted it, it's on, so you've got one shelf full of sex books, and then you've got another shelf. And the only title that jumped out on the other shelf for me at first was Exotic Aquarium Fishes. Uh-huh. So at first I was like, okay, so the second shelf isn't sex books? So I backed it up because I wanted to be sure and paused it and looked closely and like, no, on the second shelf, everything else is sex except for Exotic Aquarium Fishes. And I'm like, well, I'll be damned. So the secret door, I don't know why. So the secret door opens and there's a sex chamber behind it, basically, yeah, with bondage equipment and toys.
Shag carpet.
Lava lamps, of course, because you got to have lava lamps for sex rooms in the 70s.
It's like a van, a 70s van that's a room,
yeah.
Not a van.
Well said. But you know what else is in that room?
Big ass aquarium.
Yep.
With exotic fishes in it.
Yep.
There you go.
There you
detail.
Go.
Detail. Attention to detail.
Damn right. And
but Bill goes in the room and there's a bunch of mail on a bunch of letters, and he starts reading one. And one of the letters, it turns out, is kind of a love letter.
Yeah.
To another dude.
Yeah.
From Murger. And then all of a sudden this dude jumps up from behind the aquarium.
Yeah.
And foolishly tries to fight Bill. Yeah.
This would be Murger's truck stop lover, we find out.
Yeah. And Bill punches him, knocks him out, and he wakes him up and says, hey, what's the deal here? What's going on? And basically he explains that they met, they hit it off, they decided to be together instead of going around, you know, or have liaisons together instead of randomly meeting people. So, but he, after he was murdered, this guy came back to get all letters because he didn't want this guy, neither one of them were out at this point. It was the 70s. And so to save this guy's name, he came back to get all this mail that had any references off of it. And Bill's like, okay, but hey, by the way, before he leaves, is there any way he could get it on with a girl? And the guy's like, no, no way. He had no interest.
Well, he says, tell me, could he get it on with a woman? Long pause. No way. It's all dramatic.
Like, yeah.
So the point is that he could not be seduced. He could not be seduced by the B-girls.
That's why they ran him over the car.
That's why they ran him over with the car.
Yeah. Because at that point, he knew what was going on. So Bill's starting to put two and two together at this point. Yeah, but that whole scene was played really matter-of-factly.
Yeah.
There wasn't a big deal made out of the guy being homosexual.
No, you know, it really wasn't. No, it's like the only reason why they tussled is because a truck stop lover attacked Bill Smith first.
So. Yeah, and Bill is, you know, he's like, hey, I'm just doing an investigative job here, find out about DeMurr. Once the guy calms down,
Bill Smith couldn't care less.
And that was kind of cool in this scene, because usually in a lot of these movies, you know, they try to make them a little more flamboyant.
Yeah.
Or they try to make a big deal out of the sexual.
Yeah, but Truck Stop Lover is just a, you know, strapping, good looking guy.
Gary Sandy looking guy.
Yeah.
How you like that?
Yeah.
Gary Sandy?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I guess this is around the time that we get, because before now we have seen Anitra Ford, who is the lady scientist, who's the queen of the B-girls, basically.
Yeah.
We've seen her around, and she's been discussed as the iceberg, but she hasn't really taken part in the action much until about this time.
Yeah,
in the
she's
movie,
just been kind of the overseer.
Where
of
she
everything.
Sort of moves into the foreground and starts getting more involved in the action.
Yeah.
And one of the scientists who I described in my own head as a middle-aged balding swinger guy. Now, middle-aged balding swinger guy, this is a common thing that you see in the 70s, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where we're presented with some sort of doughy, hairy, and or balding, middle-aged, nondescript kind of cat who we're supposed to buy into as being a swinger who's having
college
all this...
college professor or doctor
who's
or
having all
like
this...
That.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All professional
this
cat.
Yeah, yeah, sort of like Doc on Love Boat, you know? I mean, he wasn't doughy, but...
No, but he was the last guy that you
Bernie Capel
to be a ladies
is like
man.
The last guy you expect to be getting all the ladies,
yeah.
You know?
I mean, Dick Gaudio shows up on Love Boat. You know...
Yeah.
You know, there's going to be some tired women, but Bernie Capel?
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah. And like in a movie like this, you could, if you wanted to theorize about that guy, we'll just shorten it to middle-aged swinger guy. If you wanted to theorize about him, you could say, well, like he's the audience identification figure, right? So all the middle-aged wannabe swingers in the audience that have come to see boobs, are more like him than they are like a Bill Smith. And so we want to show him getting all the action so they can feel like they're part of the action. And I would almost buy that as a theory were it not for the fact that, as we've already established, in those days, this was as common on television, like in sitcoms, as it was anywhere else, right? I almost want to say that Mr. Furley on Three's Company is sort of a satire of that, you know, of that trend in a way.
Yeah.
We're going deep here.
Yeah.
But...
jeez. You know, I would have put money on Furley would not have been brought up this whole time. If somebody would have came to me before we started this, and said, hey, you think Mr. Furley would be mentioned anytime during a recording?
But you know exactly what I'm talking about.
I do.
About middle-aged swinger guy.
Well, you see him in all these movies.
Yeah.
You know, now even Kolchak. The werewolf episode where they go on the boat. It was like a swinger's cruise.
Yeah.
Dick Gaudier.
Yeah.
Speaking of, he was on that episode. But yeah, there, you know, he was the guy that you, like you say, you identify, you hope the hopeful guy.
Yeah.
Because there was the other scientist guy who his wife said, yeah, if I thought it would kill you, I'd do it. He's the guy you feel sorry for. Okay, you kind of identify with because he's a regular guy, doctor, same thing, middle-aged guy. But this guy is the opposite. Like, you, okay, he's going to, you know. And
I mean, there is an element of, you know, dudes could be dudes and be considered sexy dudes or sex symbols or attractive to ladies back in those days. I mean, even, you know, move it forward into the 80s. And can you imagine Magnum PI era Tom Selleck being a sex symbol today, you know, when all men have to be waxed and
androgynous
and
a boyish looking.
Yeah, yeah. Or while simultaneously being buff or whatever. Which reminds me, I saw a trailer, not because I wanted to. You know how YouTube just shows you what it wants to show you when you're trying to watch something else? A quick trailer for the upcoming Baywatch movie with The Rock.
Oh, jeez. And the whole, I did not know there was going to be one.
The whole thing is showing shirtless dudes.
Wow.
You get a very, very brief glimpse of ladies in bathing suits at the beginning of the trailer. And then the whole rest of the trailer is The Rock and some pretty boy getting oily and shirtless. The whole thing.
Wow.
It's just friggin' bizarre. It's like the whole Daniel Craig coming up out of the water like Ursula Andress thing, which just, please stop it. But anyway, the point I was making, if I was making a point, was that you can definitely say that you could be a man that actually looked like a man and still be considered attractive to the ladies back in those days. But that's not what we're talking about.
No.
Because middle-aged swinger guy does not look like Magnum P.I.
No. He looks like your doctor, you know? He looks like just like the pharmacist. Yeah, he does, you know? Just a regular average slump that you just wouldn't expect is going to go out on a Friday night and go home with anybody. That being said, he's having taking a break.
He gets to hook up with Anitra Ford.
She comes on to him.
Yeah.
And it says, we need to go out or have dinner or yada, yada, yada. So he calls his wife and says he's going to be working late. And goes to work late.
And then we get a prolonged seduction and striptease scene with Anitra Ford.
And there's this weird, in the middle of that, I got to point out, it's a very bizarre scene. I was watching it going, what the hell's going on? They're facing each other. He's trying to touch her, caress her. She keeps putting his hands down. It's like, you know, now I'm going to do all the work.
Let me drive.
She starts undressing him and he gets, you know, takes his pants down, getting his shirt. She starts to touch her. He tries to touch her again. She's like, no, put the hands down. You're thinking, okay, she's being seductive, you know what I mean? Which she is. And then she lays him down and she strips down. And then she lays down. He's laying on his back. She's laying down facing us with, I think, her head towards his feet. They're opposite. With her back towards him and kind of writhing a little bit. I'm like, what are they doing? There's not any real physical contact except maybe, you know, back to side.
Her butt.
Yeah, but his hands aren't touching her. She's not touching
him. It's a nice butt.
Or maybe she's facing him.
I think she's facing him.
She's facing him, but she's kind of, her head's kind of turned up.
She lays down beside him, but with her
face to feet,
right. Yeah. But she's not facing us. She's facing him. Yeah, but
they're not really doing anything. And then all of a sudden she stops and says, and it basically is like, okay, now we're going to do it. And then she climbs on top of him.
I didn't. Weird. I noticed that. I didn't think much of it. I mean, I guess I kind of looked at that as maybe for composition's sake or something. But the bottom line is she ends up on top of him, and then we get to see the big black bee eyes. And we do occasionally get multivision, the compound eye.
The bee vision. Yeah. That's how you know something's going on.
Yep.
It happens one time a little earlier in the film. I can't remember where you see from the woman's point of view. And what she sees in front of her is like the kaleidoscope bee vision, which is, I guess, why they're always wearing sunglasses. They're sensitive to light and they don't want people to see that they got bee eyes.
Yeah. She's got the compound eyes. So you get the camera view of the compound eyes, which is pretty cool.
That's
a cool little trick.
Yeah.
Before, like in The Fly.
Yeah, exactly. Before, after that happens, one of the girl's husband dies. Maybe it was him. Maybe that was the one. And this is where we see the transformation with the wax and the bees to his wife.
Yeah.
A few days later, we see the funeral, which is, this is a kind of a neat kind of 70s horror movie kind of shot for me, where they have the funeral and then all the people that are coming on to the cult side or the bad guy side are together at the funeral, kind of dressed alike, kind of, you know.
Black low-cut dresses. Yeah.
Black low-cut dresses. They're all sexy at a funeral, but all in black and all have sunglasses on. And the widow's sitting there with, did you notice the netting over her face is kind of a honeycomb kind of look? But you know, every once in a while, Anitra Ford to put her hand on the girl's shoulder. And then one of the other girls put her hand on the shoulder, like, we're here with you, sister. We're all together. You know?
Well, that's a.
And nobody else notices that anything strange yet with that happening.
No, Victoria Vitri does. She's eyeballing them.
Oh, yeah. Well, they have this little radiation device, like a Geiger counter. It reads gamma radiation or something. So she's got one of those. And she very clandestinely between Agar and the cop holds it up so we can see it, and points it at the girls over there and emits some kind of high-pitched whine that only bees can hear or something. Because a couple of the girls, Nitra Ford, a couple of girls give me that, what? Look around, like, where's that coming from kind of thing.
Yeah, while Nitra Ford is seducing a middle-aged swinger, we're cutting back and forth between that and Agar and Victoria watching
a bee documentary. Yeah,
and I don't remember why they're watching that. And I've seen it, like I said, I've seen the movie a couple times, but it's not so much that I have a hard time following it or don't know what it's about, because I don't. But I do feel like in the back half of it, it starts to make logical leaps, or maybe leaving out exposition such that people are just kind of figuring out what's going on without me really understanding how they're figuring it out.
Well, like I said, I still don't remember how the bee thing started.
There's a scientist who's not present
that
they're only talking about.
Yeah,
that apparently Nitra Ford was working with or for. Either she was his partner or was his assistant or whatever she was.
Yeah,
and he is the. I guess he was the instigator of the bee research, and she ends up getting turned into the queen bee. And I guess we're supposed to assume she kills him because he's just not there. He disappears.
Yeah. But I mean, how did she get turned to begin with?
No, they don't get into that.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I'm saying.
They don't get into that.
How did it start?
There's a couple of things like that, again, in the back half of the movie where you're just kind of going, I'm not sure how we got here, but okay.
Yeah.
It's not like a huge deal, but it is a departure from sort of the flow and pace of the early half, which I think works really well, you know, for the most part.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk about the transformation scene because in terms of...
Me too, because it's a bit of nudity.
In terms of chronological discussion, that's where we are at this point, is where Nitra Ford summons one of the widows to meet her and the B-girls kidnap her and take her into the hidden lab.
Yeah.
And they begin the transformation sequence. So you've kind of described how it goes. They put her in a machine and flash lights on her, and then they cover her in wax and put her in another machine and flash more lights on her, and bees gather all over her. And then when the bees are gone and the wax is hardened, they peel the wax off, and she's had a makeover, and she's gorgeous. I mean, that's essentially how it goes. Now, the first chamber they put her in with all the wires and whatnot on it, which is, I guess it was chosen for its shape, which is evocative of... honeycombs or a beehive, but it's a jungle gym.
It's a jungle gym.
Yeah, it's a jungle gym.
I was like, man, we used to have one of those at the schoolyard. Yeah. But one of those domed jungle gyms.
But this scene, the transformation scene as a whole, this is the reason why this movie goes from, hey, that was fun, to I really like this movie.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. It's so good. It's so cool. Okay, so...
And there's lots of boobs.
It is pretty much just what we described,
yeah,
in terms of what happens in it.
Yeah.
It's 8.5 minutes long.
It goes on a little bit.
It doesn't feel 8.5 minutes
long. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It doesn't feel like it's droning on.
There's no dialogue.
No.
It's silent. It's pure. I said I got to be careful because I don't want to oversell this thing.
Yeah.
And we have to remember what kind of movie we're talking about here and be real about it. But damn it, it's 8.5 minutes of pure cinema. Just visual, or sort of hypnotic visual storytelling with no dialogue, sound effects and music and visuals.
And let me set up the lab though real quick, because we talked briefly on that. It's a big open area with a lot of stuff in it. It's not like the Strickfaden labs where every square inch is covered with equipment. There's a bankle of 70s computers would have flashy lights, random flashy lights. There's a couple of three or four freestanding pieces of equipment that emit radiation, I guess, the pointy, like laser-looking things. Over on the other side, there's some other podiums or panel things. And then there's the jungle gym thing that has wires and stuff around it. And then there's another little thing. There's a booth that after she gets covered in the wire, they put her in and close her in this booth.
Yeah.
Other than that, there's nothing on the back walls. You don't see the back wall, really. I think in the light, it just fades into darkness back there. And then you've got Anitra Ford and all the B-girls around in lab coats and sunglasses.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
And the B-girls are tending to the transformees, and Ford is in the background sort of working switches and
watching. And has that seductive evil grin.
Yeah, seductively and evilly. And you have to see it. I can't necessarily describe it, but so well. You know, great use of lighting. There's a lot of colored light. And great editing and montage, a lot of lap dissolves and interesting cuts and close-ups. And
the sexuality of it isn't overplayed during this scene, except for, I mean, because the girl's naked, but yeah. You don't see her below the waist. They got one of those laser things positioned, so you just see her top. And except for Anitra Ford, that real grinning, evil, seductive look on her face, that's really about it. And even when they start putting the wax on her,
rubbing the wax on her body, that is pretty hot.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, there's one girl rubbing it all over her boobs,
and then
stuff.
Eventually she's got it on her nethers, and so she's not covered down there, but because it's the '70s, you can tell exactly where her business is under the wax.
Yeah, and they show it, but I will say they don't really linger on it.
It's not,
and there's not that. They don't have that mood music playing.
It's not so. No, it's not so porned up.
It's not porned up.
It's not so porned up that if you watched it, you'd say, "Oh, that's why Mercer's so fascinated with this scene."
Yeah,
it really isn't. As a matter of fact, if it were porned up like that, it would have ruined it.
Yeah.
The scene is telling a story visually. That is what it is doing. And it is doing... It
only until the end of the scene.
Yeah.
Do they throw in a little bit of cheesecake or like, we gotta porn it up a little bit here to keep them interested. The people who aren't, I guess, paying attention. Yeah. At the end of the scene, when she's come out, had the makeover, and it's about all over, Anitra Ford comes over to her, and the girl herself has her eyes closed, and she starts almost rubbing her tits, herself. Her hands, she's caressing herself. Then one of the other B-girls that shows her, she slides her hand under the top of her lab coat. And another girl, for no reason, pulls her lab coat open and exposes both of her boobs and starts rubbing those. Anitra Ford comes over and kisses the girl that had the makeover.
Yeah.
And then it ends.
And you know, there's this little detail that I really liked.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, so I can't really explain it. I just liked it. Ford enters the shot to kiss the transformee at the end of her process after she's had her makeover. And when she pulls away, she's clearly wearing lip gloss because she leaves the gloss behind on the transformed girl's mouth.
Yeah.
And under the lights, it shines really bright, but they keep it.
Yeah.
They don't like cut and get it off and then start over. They keep the gloss on the lips and they push in for the close-up and you can see sort of the shine of the lip gloss around the mouth. And why that is, I like that, I don't know. But just I don't think
you can see that on the DVD copy. Okay. I mean, because it was ripped from VHS, so the quality's not good.
Yeah.
I'll have to check that out on the Blu-ray.
You should at least sort of skim through that scene on the Blu-ray, especially so you can get a better sense of what I'm on about. But yeah, you know, it's like I said, the scene tells a story. It's not an elaborate story or a long one, but it's lit and shot very nicely. Gosh, I'm at a loss for words.
In other hands, it could have been cheesy and porned up.
Well, no. So yes, I am doing a horrible job of just sort of describing the appeal of the scene. But that point you just made, I think, is key, which is that we have seen enough of these kinds of things to know how excruciating 8.5 minutes of that would have been in the vast majority of this movie's ilk.
Yeah.
In the vast majority of drive-in schlock or sexploitation schlock or whatever, 8.5 minutes of that would have been torture.
Yeah. And I think that's the whole point of this discussion.
Yeah.
Is, like you say, you love this movie. You don't want to oversell it because of the type of movie it is.
Yeah.
And it is really a small little basic little movie.
Yeah.
And like I said, when I watched, I'm like, I know I could tell you the whole plot, but I really don't know what it was about.
Yeah.
Because it's not much of a movie, but what it is and what was done with it, as far as from the director and the actors, they rose above the material.
Yeah.
They made the material rise above what it probably was gonna be. Even the script changes from would have loved to see what Nick Meyer's original script was, even with what it was changed to, what they did with that makes it kind of a unique movie, where it could have been super cheesy. That could have been, like you said, that long scene could have been excruciating and felt long, and it could have been porned up and really exploitive or exploitation, but it wasn't really until those last couple of seconds, like I said, when they're all showing their boobs and rubbing them. But that's only like, what, 2 seconds of screen time, really? So the whole rest of it is, like you said, really a nice little transformation scene. And the whole rest of the movie is that way, where it could have been, even that line, they're dropping like flies, Agar. Yeah. The line itself, cheesy, could have been worse.
Oh, yeah.
But the way he delivers it and the way the scene is shot and the two characters react to each other, you don't feel it is being that cheesy.
The whole thing is much more competently put together than I expected, which is probably why it made the big impression on me that it did. I mean, probably, you know, I like to get those drive-in double feature discs or quadruple feature or whatever things and just watch things that I haven't seen before, as we both do, and check some of that stuff out. So the main draw for me wanting to watch this movie, aside from the cast, which was part of it, was that great poster.
Oh, yeah.
Great poster.
Oh, yeah.
So I was like, hell yeah. But I mean, I'm not actually expecting this to be good. I'm not actually expecting to even get through it in one sitting. But, you know, to understand my sort of huge positive reaction, put yourself in that frame of mind. You're expecting very little, if anything, and you find this little gem in the middle of this thing you wouldn't expect to find it in.
Yeah.
You know, that scene I'm talking about. And I was wondering, when I watched it again, I was wondering if I would react to it as strongly as I did the first time. And I really did. I wasn't even actively analyzing, okay, why is it that I like this so much the way I would normally? Because I actually find it kind of hypnotic in a way, which just explains why it's 8 friggin' minutes and you don't feel it.
Yeah.
But Kim watched it with me, and when that scene was over, she was like, wow. And I was like, right?
You know? Like if Phyllis was watching with me the other night. And you know, the things I like about it is also the little things, like the scenes, the interaction between Agar and the sheriff.
Yeah.
Like I said, just a couple of real guys doing their jobs. And it's not, they're nothing awkward. Even the scenes with Bill by himself, like looking through somebody's office or doing his job, it's almost got like that James Garner kind of regular guy. Okay, he's going through, I got it. It's not forced. Like he's looking at this and he's acting. He's like half-ass smoking a cigarette while he's looking through this. And he puts this down. He goes over here and he's just going about his, and then he sees something he's got to look at. It just feels natural. Like that was Bill's job before he got into acting.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
it's cheap, it's tacky, it's exploitation, guilty, 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 all of the above, but it's not bad. This is the kind of movie, if somebody tells me they think this is a bad movie, I know that person hasn't seen enough bad movies.
Yeah.
And that's the truth.
Yeah. You know? It's a low budget movie.
Yeah.
It's a low budget movie.
Yeah.
A quickie movie. Play the grindhouse of drive-in circuits. Of course it did. But it rises above most of that time.
Yep. It's pacey. That's another thing. Another thing a lot of these movies are not is pacey. It does not linger at any time.
There's no point at where it drags or slows
on
down.
Unjustified shots. In other words, shots that don't merit lingering on, it does not linger. It keeps it moving. So, and it moves in a coherent fashion. Story-wise, it's choppy in places, but editing, in terms of, you know, montage editing, it's not a problem.
There's one thing, the very end, where it's the happy ending, and they have to have that 70s dun-dun, or is it, ending. It's a happy ending, Bill and the girl are embracing, and the camera comes outside, and you hear the beginnings of dun-dun, the 2001 music.
The Sprock Zarathustra.
Yeah, and then it goes to shows a bee and a flower, and dun-dun.
Yeah. Now that's camp. That's camp.
That's the only part that made me laugh.
That tips
part
the
right
car
there.
Over into camp a little bit. Yeah.
Other than that, give the movie a watch. If you can get it on Blu-ray, definitely get the Blu-ray. I'm going to find out for myself in a few minutes how good that is.
If you're the kind of person that would buy something like Invasion of the B-Girls on Blu-ray, and you know who you are, then you definitely need to buy it for sure.
Yeah. If you don't, but you're curious, I'm sure there's a low quality version on YouTube.
Well, check the Shout channel on Roku. Maybe it'll be on there.
Yeah, it might be on that. I know it's on one of the Grindhouse Grit channel on Roku.
Or even I think the transfer that's on that 4-movie Shout Factory release that I got with Unholy Rollers.
Yeah.
Is pretty good.
Yeah.
I think that was probably from an HD master done for, even though the DVD is standard definition, I think that transfer was probably an HD master done for television. Doesn't look as good as the Blu-ray, but it looks good.
Another thing I wonder.
It'd be cheaper.
Yeah. We'll bring it up real quick. You know how we were talking about it? The material could be so-so in other hands. It could be crap. But the director, the actors made it rise above. I was watching a movie the other night. It's one of those something weird titles I'd never heard of. Called This Stuff Will Kill You. It was about moonshining and this religious sect and this Southern Hellfire and Damnation preacher. Okay. The guy that played the preacher in this, this old, middle-aged, overweight guy playing this reverend. Everybody else in it was crap actors, okay? This guy, I don't know who he was. I believe that he probably was one of these preachers at one point. I mean, this guy was good. He had that crazy look, but not camping it up. He stood out above everything else in this movie. Is like, that's the only guy that's making this me want to keep watching and making it believable. Is I believe that he could have been that guy. The where he's above the law. No, you're going to, well, everybody's going to do what I say because I'm the reverend. Like that.
You guys think you're above the law?
Yeah.
You ain't above mine.
I'm going to have to find out this actor, because I saw him in another movie where he just played a sheriff.
One thought he was invincible. The other thought he could fly. They were both wrong.
They were both wrong. But this, it was weird because the movie was a nothing movie, but it's worth watching to see this guy's performance in it. I'll have to show you some of it to see what,
yeah,
I mean.
Cool.
I mean, because the guy...
What's it called again?
I think it's called This Stuff Will Kill You.
Okay.
And he just had the crazy eyes, and the way he did this role, you believed he was this dude. Because everybody else in it, like I said, was high school play acting, pretty much.
Oh, yeah. Acting-wise, I will say there are some rough moments in B-Girls for Victoria Vitry, for sure. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, she's probably the one of the weaker performances. Stunning lady.
Yeah.
And it's funny because in the scenes where she's just got to act natural and flirt with Bill Smith or whatever, she's fine. There's nothing wrong.
Yeah.
But anytime she's got to play scientist, like there's a bit towards the end where she's got to deliver some science-y exposition. Ooh, it's rough.
But, yeah. But everybody else in it has pretty good chemistry together.
Yeah.
It works well. Again, this is, you know, like I say, every episode here, judge for yourself, watch the movie, seek it out if you haven't seen it. Make your own conclusions and decisions, but definitely sit down and watch it. And keep in mind some of the things that we pointed out. It'll come up as you're watching, like, oh yeah, okay, I see that now. To whereas if you just watch it maybe on a whim, who knows, with a title like Invasion of the B-Girls, you're expecting something completely different.
Yeah, well, you're still going to get what you would hope for from a movie called Invasion of the B-Girls.
Oh, yeah.
And can I say, I really do appreciate the sheer variety of sizes and shapes of breasts we are afforded B-Girls.
Yeah, all, it's the 70s. They're all real women. Not plastic, not CoverGirl models.
One might have been some unfortunate implants. I'm not sure. but that just adds to the variety of sizes and shapes that you get.
Yeah. It's not cookie cutter.
No.
All right.
Hey, you were telling me before we started, and we agreed that we would hold it until the podcast, about the Ebert review.
Yes. Believe it or not, maybe this will sway your opinion, maybe it won't, but when this movie came out, Roger Ebert gave this movie 2.5 out of 3 stars. He gushed over this being almost a perfect science fiction film. His review, it's online, you can look it up, had nothing but good things to say about this movie. It blew my mind.
I'm glad. I'm sorry I haven't read that. I'm glad to hear it. I'm sorry I haven't read it. I'm definitely going to have to read it. I'm surprised I haven't read it. I have to say, it doesn't necessarily surprise me, not because of how much I like the movie, although I do, but because I'm a big fan of Ebert's. I've read a lot of his work and some of his books and whatnot.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a big fan of his, not necessarily because I agree with all of his assessments, but because A, he's a good writer.
Uh-huh.
And B, because he comes from a place of, you know, he loves movies and he wants to communicate to you his emotional experiences of watching this particular film that he's reviewing.
Yeah.
And that really seems to be all his agenda amounts to, which I can appreciate. It doesn't matter. If you're a good writer and you can communicate your ideas well and you're sincerely coming from a place of wanting to discuss and write about cinema, I have all the time for you in the world. Unfortunately, a lot of critics have agendas that have nothing to do with the content of the movie. They're all trying to fit everything into some sort of template to move along some agenda of their own. And that's a whole other subject we could spend a lot of time on and probably shouldn't. But Ebert is largely free, not entirely, nobody is free of bias, but he's largely free of that kind of thing most of the time. And he, you know, was capable at times of being quite friendly to genre material, but you have to remember, the reason why this particular review doesn't surprise me, this is the guy that was friends with Russ Meyer.
Oh, yes.
This is the guy that wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
That's right.
And so he is quite capable of being able to appreciate what is actually good or not in a movie like this. If you catch him on the right day and, you know, he's in the right headspace and he's engaged with it, you know, it doesn't surprise me that he liked it. I like to know the particulars of why he liked it. That's why I need to read the review.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's
I won't assume anything.
Easy to find. Yeah.
But in terms of watching a sexploitation movie and finding that it's worthwhile, again, Ebert was a real champion of Myers and thought rightly that Meyer was a hell of a filmmaker, which he was.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things where Meyer was a division breaker. One of those things where I told you I kind of went through a sexploitation, or maybe I didn't get into this. I said that I had some experience with sexploitation movies where when you got into the end of the 90s and DVD was starting and something weird had been well established on VHS and was now branching into DVD, and all these boutique labels started up to deliver cult movies on DVD. You remember that sort of time where you could actually walk into a Best Buy, for example, and find all kinds of interesting things on DVD that you'd never find today. And things became accessible. It was easy to go down, and you know, the early days of Netflix and all that stuff. It became easy to go down rabbit holes. And I did, you know, with the sexploitation genre, which was something that I had been interested in from reading things like Incredibly Strange Film Guide and things of that nature. And you just hadn't had access to the material, but you were familiar with it through reading and you were curious. And it's something I'm glad I learned about, but not anything that kind of stayed with me. I'm not someone that sort of chases after that stuff anymore at all, because the vast majority of it is not
good. Oh,
It's not good, not worthwhile. A lot of it, unfortunately, is in either the roughy space, which has no interest for me, except for a few standouts that are interesting for reasons beyond kind of their approach to the sex or whatever. And the whole nudie cutie thing, you know, those are sort of the two extremes of the spectrum, neither of which are very interesting. And then a lot of things in between, much of which is not very competent and not very interesting at all, you know. So the lure of it is not necessarily the sex, although, you know, that sure as hell doesn't hurt, but just this whole undiscovered underworld of cinema that I didn't know about.
Uh-huh.
And when I got there, I found most of it, again, not very interesting, with the exception of Russ Meyer. Now, I had seen some Meyer before the DVD era. I had a beat-up bootleg of Faster Pussycat on VHS for a long time. But when I really got to explore that catalog, what I mean by division breaker is you really don't need to bother anymore with the rest of the body of sexploitation when you have access to Meyer, because that's the best of the best. You know, it's the best of the best. It's as good as it gets in terms of just being entertaining.
Yeah.
The worst thing a movie, so we talked before about how people who want to say something like this is bad haven't seen enough bad movies. Being cheap or being any number of things you could accuse something of being does not necessarily make it bad. The worst thing a movie could possibly be is boring.
Yeah.
And a lot, regardless of its relative quality or conventional accomplishment of this sexploitation stuff, is boring as hell.
Yeah.
I like beautiful women. I like seeing boobs as much as anybody else.
Hear, hear.
I'm not opposed to softcore, neither am I attracted to it, but whatever.
Yeah.
But just trying to sit through these things as features, dull as hell, lot of it. Not
a lot, yeah. I want to know exactly what I'm talking about.
Because you've been here too.
Yeah.
And you have your own little something weird collection.
Oh, yeah. Now, I will watch any movie Something Weird puts out.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by that type of film. Whether it's a nudie cutie, whether it's no sex involved, whether it's a roughie, whether it's a horror movie or just a slice of life kind of picture. Good, bad, whatever. That's a whole separate discussion, though. But real quick, I'm fascinated. Movies that came out that time, 60s, 70s, they played on a screen somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they made it to a theater because there was no cable. There was no direct-to-video. Nothing like that was even existed. These movies actually played in the theater. People actually paid to go see them.
That's an important distinction, and you're absolutely right. And when I say when I talk about a short-lived fascination with the sexploitation genre, I am not talking about Skinemax. I am not talking about direct-to-video.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about the whole endless, vast universe of that shit you can
talk
get
now. Pretty much pre-mid-80s.
I'm talking about stuff that was actually shot on film for theatrical release in the 60s and 70s, during a period where the standards and taboos that had held that sort of thing back from having, from playing in theaters for so long had finally relaxed and or dissolved, depending on what period we're talking about.
Yeah.
And now, because they could, producers were flooding grindhouse theaters with this sex material.
Yeah.
Right. That is what we're talking about when we say sexploitation, that specific period.
Yeah. And like I said, I'll watch any of that stuff. Now, will I watch Olga's House of Shame? Yeah. Will I watch it again? Probably not.
Well, it's an experience. You know? It's an experience to see that. It speaks of a time. It speaks of a place. It's probably going to have some images in it. Hopefully, it'll have images in it you haven't seen anywhere quite before. But to sit through, you know, 60 to 90 minutes of whatever that thing is, it's probably going to be boring as hell more often than not.
And there's a lot of titles. Like, I mean, I was watching one the other day, Sin in the Suburbs or The Day of the Nightmare.
Yeah.
Well, and I've watched them. Will I watch them again? If I'm bored and don't remember really what it was about, I might put it on. But will I seek it out to sit down and watch it again? Probably not, because they were kind of boring. Like you say, B-Girls, I'll watch that again at some point because it was an enjoyable film.
Yeah.
And it moved, like you said, the pacing of it, it was steady the whole way.
Yeah. So, and that's what I'm saying. So a lot of that stuff is just dull and not very inspired, not very well done. Meyer was actually, I'm going to go ahead and say, a genius filmmaker, certainly a genius editor, who had a passion, if not a craze, to do to make the kind of movies he made. A guy who, if he had wanted to, could have had a conventional career making conventional films.
Yeah.
But had his own muse to chase, and he made these crazy, sexy, weird, wild, funny, fast movies that he made. That I say they're division breakers, because if you're curious about sexploitation, do what you gotta. But if you want my advice, just watch Russ Meyer and leave the rest of that shit on the shelf where it belongs, with the occasional exception. And I would definitely say that B-Girls is one of those exceptions. And knowing that Ebert admired and was befriended by and worked with Meyer as a real filmmaker, it doesn't surprise me that he sort of had the capacity as a critic to open his brain to this kind of thing.
So. Yeah. Now, the Blu-ray, who put that out?
Shout?
Okay. So it came out April 4th of this year. Brand new release on Blu-ray. Easy access, easy to find. Once again, Roku, budget DVD. You can find it on Amazon probably. Check it out. Watch it yourself. Make your own conclusions. If you don't agree with anything we said, hey, drop us a line at the Phantasmo email. That's phantasmoad@gmail.com. Phantasmode, all one word, @gmail.com. Or throw us a shout on the Facebook page, Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page. I will be posting the trailer for this film on there and as many stills and images as I can find in a folder on there, so you can look at it at your pleisure while you listen to the podcast. I gotta mention, there's this one.
Don't be looking in pleasure when you...
There's this one
you
shot.
Know what? You know what? If you can have pleasure while you're listening to this podcast, you do you, baby.
You do your thing.
And that's all right. Glad to help.
I'll drink to that. Yes, I will. There's this one image at the end where Bill is rescuing Victoria Vetri, and she's naked, halfway in the transformation, and he goes in there and shoots up the place. And if you watch, every time he fires the gun, he kind of closes his eyes and blinks because he doesn't like guns.
I will tell you, I did not catch that.
So. Any movie he's in where he shoots a gun, you watch, he'll like blink as he does it, because he doesn't really like guns.
He doesn't need them, damn it.
No,
he's got two tickets to the gun show.
That's right. But he goes over and he grabs Victoria Venture, one arm around her waist, bodily picks her up, and is walking out with her like a suitcase under his arm and with gun and moving stuff around. But I've got a still, the first picture I ever had signed from him. Is a still of that, him walking out with the body, and he just signed to Rob, "You should have been there," Bill Smith.
Yes, we should have.
So maybe I'll post that picture on there just for the hell of it. But check it out. Check out the Facebook page. Drop us a line. And I think that's about it on this one, huh?
Yeah, I think we pretty much killed it.
All right. Well, till next time, thanks for listening. Good night.
Good night.